Good morning.
Good morning.
I always look forward to coming here, mostly because I get to see some folks that I don't normally get to see, which is one of the reasons I still accompany my wife to the grocery store. She goes with a list and is there to get the food. I'm there to see people and socialize. But I'm not seeing a lot of you there, so just so you know, I'm there generally, we're there mid-morning, late morning, early afternoon, Saturday and Sunday, so come out and we'll socialize.
Well, which grocery store?
We go to all of them, so we kind of switch it up around. Not all at the same time, but this week we might go to Giant Eagle, next week maybe it's Tops, who knows. Sometimes even Walmart, hate to admit it, but there we are. So what would it take to make Meadville the kindest community in America? And as it turns out, not that much. We can do this. One good deed can actually launch a wave and create a ripple effect that could impact thousands. And I'll give you an example. And this was something that I saw on television. CBS did this thing called The Gift. Came on right before the holidays. And they talked about these acts of kindness that started with one person and spiraled and rippled out and impacted so many others. One of my favorite stories was about a homeless man who was down to his last penny, sleeping out of his car, out of work, starving, and landed in Houston, Mississippi, in front of a diner called the Dixie Diner. And so he thought, well, what do I have to lose? So he went in and ordered the largest breakfast on the menu, with no ability to pay, of course. The owner of the diner, who was no easy mark, surmised what was happening, realized that this gentleman was probably going to dine and dash. And so he did something rather remarkable. He walked up behind the gentleman who was seated in the restaurant, had a 20 cupped in his hand, and he bent down next to him and he came up and he says, sir, you must have dropped this, and handed him the $20 bill. Well, the gentleman, Larry, who was there to dine and dash, couldn't believe his good fortune. So he finished his meal, paid for the breakfast, and used the change to get gas to get out of town. This was in the days, 1970s, when you could do all of that on a $20 bill. And then somewhere on the way out of town, he realized, wait a minute, there was no 20 next to my seat. This diner owner just found a clever way to preserve my dignity. And he vowed then and there that if he ever came into some money, he would return the favor. He would pay it forward. Well, lo and behold, didn't Larry make a small fortune in the cable TV business? And became Secret Santa. And you may have heard of this over the years, but there was somebody running around the country handing out $100 bills. This was the original Secret Santa. And in 1999, he worked his way back to that diner and had a conversation with the diner owner. And the diner owner's adult children said they just sat there and held each other's hands and wept. And then Larry, the homeless guy, the TV cable mogul, handed Larry 100 $100 bills. I can see some of you doing the math. That's $10,000. And they talked about all the money that he had given away over the course of his lifetime. And it came to about $1.5 million is what he gave out in $100 increments. You know, he passed away about 10, 15 years ago, but before he did so, he recruited another gentleman to do the same thing, and that person has given away over $1 million in $100 increments. Although he put a little twist on it. In addition to giving the person $100 bills, he then said, and that's for you, but I'm going to give you another $100, and I want you to give that to somebody else. Mm-hmm. And he said, you'll find that that's the real joy. Is in the giving of the money, not the receiving of the money. Nice story. What an investment that $20 turned out to be. And what a ripple effect it had. So how do we make kindness go viral? How do we transform Meadville through kindness? Well, let's hold that thought for a second. Let's just take a deep dive for a second into what kindness is. I believe kindness is probably the most powerful force for good that exists in the entire world. Because kindness is love. And what is love? Well, we get a great description of love in Corinthians when Paul is reaching out to the church there, and he says, love is patient, love is kind. He goes on to say many other things, but I want to focus on that love is kind piece. In other words, kindness then is love in action. And in a world filled with struggle and pain and anger and hatred, kindness is like a deep cleansing breath that rejuvenates us with its purity, it refreshes us with its goodness, and it gives us strength to persevere through the hard times. Kindness, then, is a reminder of who we are and why we're here and how each of us can take care of one another. But kindness involves choice. It involves choice because often when dealing with others and in tough situations and circumstances, there are many other ways that we can respond. In fact, I would argue that kindness is probably the last thing we're often thinking of when we're faced with people who would espouse hatred and bias and prejudice and ugliness. These are some tough times that we're living through. You know, our politics have become toxic. Even religion has become weaponized. And we're living during a time when even in our schools, school children, six-year-olds, come to school with a gun and terrorize teachers and classmates. And think about this. Every day, all day long, people are shouting at us. If you turn on the television, the cable news pundits are shouting at us. Our politicians are shouting at us. Sometimes our faith leaders are shouting at us, and activists are shouting at us. And if it's not them, then it's family members or neighbors, coworkers, friends. It just feels like everyone is shouting at us and telling us who we should be afraid of, who we should beware of, who we should hate. And I won't, be angry or beware of the liberals or beware of the right wingers, the Republicans or the Democrats, this person or that person. And of course, social media amplifies all of it. So we're just bombarded all day long. And it gets old, does it not? I mean, it's such an attack on the soul, and it becomes wearisome. Now, over the holidays, I rewatched a movie that came out in 1995, and perhaps you've seen it. It's called An American President. It was written by Aaron Sorkin. She forgot to do that as well. Can you hear it?
It was off, so I turned it back. When I picked it up, I turned it back on.
Karen's always got my back. And she likes to add a little music as well. Anyway, the movie was written by Aaron Sorkin. You might remember he's also the person who wrote The West Wing. The movie was directed by Rob Reiner, and it stars Michael Douglas as a widowed president here in the United States who falls in love with an environmental lobbyist played by Annette Bening. Now, with his relationship with the lobbyist opens up the door for his prime political opponent, Senator Bob Rumson, played by Richard Dreyfuss, to launch an attack on his character, something that didn't come up in the first election because his wife had just recently passed away, so everyone avoided it. But now it's fair game, and this particular senator is making hay of it. The president does not want to engage in a character debate, so he largely ignores him, but his poll numbers are plummeting. His advisors are encouraging him to say something, to do something. So out of the blue, the president steps up to the microphone at a White House press briefing, and he gives a speech, which if you've never heard, Google it. It's really a good speech. But in particular, he says this: whatever your particular problem is, I promise you Bob Rumson is not the least bit interested in solving it. He's interested in two things and two things only: making you afraid of it and telling you who's to blame for it. That, ladies and gentlemen, is how you win elections. You gather a group of middle-aged, middle-class, middle-income voters who remember with longing an easier time, and you talk to them about family and American values and character. And you wave an old photo of the president's girlfriend, and you scream about patriotism, and you tell them she's to blame for their lot in life, and you go on television, and you call her a whore. Now, does that not sound familiar? Does that not capture our times? So how do we acknowledge and then treat kindly a person whose words make your blood boil, who's standing center stage and advocating at the top of their lungs that which you would spend a lifetime opposing at the top of yours. I remember a Peanuts comic strip where Linus says to his older sister, Lucy, that he wants to become a doctor when he grows up. And Lucy kind of scoffs at him and says, "You, a doctor? You hate mankind." And Linus says, "I love mankind. It's people I can't stand." And isn't that the way of it, right? It's easy to love humanity, but there are always going to be individuals who either you dislike or you dislike the things that they're saying and the things that they're doing. For example, I really dislike that person who drives around town in that pickup truck with all the hateful flags coming out of the truck bed. That really bothers me. I don't know why, but... And I could go on, but it's Sunday morning, and we don't need to revisit all the things that we dislike. So people will surely try us, and the times are equally going to disturb us. Yet despite these challenges, we have the ability to actively choose to be kind and gracious and forgiving and understanding. Now, I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't advocate for the things and the changes we want to see, nor should we stop challenging those who would advocate for those things that we think are wrong or wrong-headed. But let's do so in a spirit of love and kindness, and let's call in and not call out. In mid-December, I attended a conference in Harrisburg sponsored by HEAL Pennsylvania. Now, HEAL PA is a newly formed coalition developed and sponsored by the Pennsylvania Governor's Office of Advocacy and Reform. And the mission of this group is to lead and support Pennsylvania in becoming trauma-informed and healing-centered by providing resources, advocacy, education via a multidisciplinary and multi-sectoral approach. It was an interesting conference. It was all day in Harrisburg, which, by the way, I learned that if you stay at the Harrisburg Hilton, it will cost you $80 to have a steak. $80. That's not all I got out of the day, but that was... Anyway, at the end of the conference, we heard from one of the keynote speakers, a gentleman named Sam Barlow, who is now 72 years old. He's an African-American man who spent 50 years in state penitentiary for second-degree felony murder. Now, Sam's story is rather interesting. He was born in 1950, and when he was 5 years old, his mother walked him to his first day of kindergarten, along with his three older siblings who were also in elementary school at the time. This is in the Pittsburgh area. And being the first day, he was encouraged to bring a toy for show and tell. Well, while on the playground, some older boys liked his Tonka truck, and some of you remember what a Tonka truck was. And they got into a fight. And the teacher, or one of the teachers, came over and scolded him for fighting on the first day of school. At the end of the day, he and his siblings walked home, and mom wasn't there. In fact, mom never showed up. And they were there for 4 or 5 days by themselves. Remember, they're all under the age of 12. Until the authorities figured out what was happening and scooped them up and put them in an orphanage. And for the next 10 years of his life, Sam was in and out of orphanages, foster care, extended relatives. And then mom shows up again with a new husband, and they go to live with mom. He's about 15 at this point. He doesn't like mom's new husband. School had cut him loose. He was running the streets around Pittsburgh. He got in with a rough crowd. And just after he turned 18, he was asked to join two of his friends to a trip in Harrisburg where they were going to rob a Dolphin Deposit Bank. Now, the reason Sam was asked to come along was because he was the only one with a driver's license and had access to a car. So they made the trip across the turnpike to Harrisburg. And Sam remained outside while the two went into the bank. And at some point, he hears a gunshot. The two come running out. They get in the car, and they take off. But the police capture them very quickly. And here are the two accomplices in the bank shot and killed an elderly patron of the bank. Now, this would have been 1968. And I think you can recall what was going on in the country at that time. The public defender told him to throw himself on the mercy of the bench. The judge, who clearly in some of his statements was a racist individual, and gave all three of them the death penalty. so for the next 4 years, these three persons spent time in Eastern State Penitentiary, where the death penalty, where they housed people who were sentenced to the death penalty. And for the first year that he was incarcerated, before there was this disposition, he was on a bread and water diet in what he called a strip cell, meaning there was nothing there. It was just an empty cell with a toilet and a cot. So he spent the next, 4 years on death row, but then the Supreme Court overturned the death penalty, and his sentence was commuted to life in prison without the opportunity for parole. He was commuted, his sentence was commuted in 2019 by Governor Wolf. The person who actually pulled the trigger died in 2013, and the other accomplice, because they were sentenced while they were a juvenile, got an early release because the Supreme Court also ruled that you can't give those kinds of sentences to juveniles. So he finally gets out in 2019, which would put him, about 68, 69 years of age. And somebody in the audience asked him if he was angry at the system or the judge or his public defender or his accomplices or his mother or the foster care system. And he said no to all of that. He said, if anything, he was angry at ignorance. Now, a lot of times, and this is something that he said, and he has written a book. It's called Life Without Murder. I think it's available now. You might want to check it out. But in there, he says, a lot of times orphans feel cheated, mad at the world. But then you get to a point where you say, well, wait a minute, I'm here. So that means somebody took care of me. Somebody had to have some sort of love to reach out and make sure I didn't die as an orphan. And you begin to look at life a little differently from that perspective, and you say, there are other people in this world, and it's not just composed of me. When you look at a life sentence, you say to yourself, well, they mean for me to die in this place. So if I never get to go, what can I learn? What can I be? How can I transform myself? One thing I did, he said, I became an imam, and I wanted to talk to others, to mentor them. So here's a man looking at the rest of his life in prison. He finishes his schooling, he gets his high school degree, he goes on to get a college degree, he becomes learned in many topics, and he, of course, now is a writer and a published author. And so as a follow-up, he was asked if he had any pearls of wisdom to share after all this time in prison, and he said yes. He said, have gratitude. Now, to be sitting in the audience, to hear from a man who spent 50 years in state prison talking to us about gratitude, I thought, wow, right? If this gentleman can have gratitude, certainly I can have gratitude. And I've been reflecting on that comment ever since. How can somebody who's been through what he's been through still feel gracious and have gratitude in his heart? Last fall, while on vacation, I developed some issues in my left eye. Now, I had cataract surgery not too long ago, and I thought, well, maybe it's the lens that they put in there. And so I didn't do anything until we got home, and even after we got home, I continued to put off being seen by a doctor. As they say, denial ain't just a river in Africa, right? But it got to the point where I clearly had an issue and needed to see somebody. And so until they could get me in, another couple of weeks go by. And now I'm sitting at Dr. Vukner's office, and he's like, well, Bruce, you have a detached retina. This is beyond my capability, so I'm going to send you up to Erie. And I get to Erie, and the doctor there says, well, Mr. Harlan, your left eye is dying. I don't think there's much I can do for you. It wasn't just a detachment. There was tearing numerous places. I mean, it was a mess. And I could see the light slowly extinguishing. I was seeing less and less each day. So I went over to the Cleveland Clinic, and a young woman, an eye surgeon, had a reason to feel optimistic and thought there was something they could do for me at Cleveland. So a couple days later, I'm under the knife, I'm out for 5 hours in what had to have been a grueling microscopic type of surgery. And when I come out of it, I have sight in my left eye. And I couldn't help but think grateful for living in a country where this kind of care is possible, where I live and work in a community where I have health insurance and a wife who can take time off from work and get me over there and back. To a surgeon who was from Eastern Europe, I was grateful that this country would welcome someone from out of the country, would allow them to be educated here, and then would welcome them into the community and allow them to practice their craft. I was just grateful for so many things and thought, why me? I'm nothing special. I'm no king. I'm no senator. I'm not a rich person. But to have access to all of that just filled my heart with gratitude, which sustained me over the holidays, because you know how it can be at the holidays, right? As much as we love the holidays, there's lots to grumble about. But I was in a very grateful spirit of mind. And there's so much that we take for granted that we're not grateful for. Being grateful to have a place to live, having food on your table, clean water, friends and family around you. These are all things to be grateful for. Being grateful for the bus showing up on time or for your car starting on a cold morning. Practicing gratitude then can be a game changer. It has far-reaching effects. It can actually boost your self-esteem and your mental health. Each of us and each of these small moments then strings together to create a kind of web of well-being that you can then bring your attention to that which you feel grateful for. And the more you notice that you're grateful for, the better off you are. Did you know that gratitude can strengthen your immune system and improve your sleep patterns? Gratitude can help you feel more optimistic, can help you experience more joy and pleasure. It can help you be more generous, and it can help you feel less lonely and isolated. And we become more grateful by affirming those good things that we receive and acknowledging the role that others play in our lives. Larry acknowledged the role that the diner owner played in his life all those years ago, and it transformed his life. So back to my original question then, is it possible to change the world with one single good deed? Now, you're probably all familiar with the way exponential growth works. If I did something nice to two people, and each of those two people did something nice for two people, you know, it goes from 2 to 4 to 8 to 16, 32, 64, 128, 256, and then I'll let Mr. Holgram take it further. But that's exponential growth, right? But the problem with that, applying that kind of an equation to the kindness piece, is you can't be sure that everybody's going to do two acts of kindness. And then, of course, the whole equation breaks down. So they took this to an MIT professor of mathematics. Apparently, Rick wasn't available. And asked if there was an equation, if you could actually calculate out how to make kindness go viral. And she says, yeah, really, it's just a probability issue. So what is the probability that the recipient of your act of kindness will pass it along, and how many people are they likely to pass it along to? And so she created an expression, a mathematical equation, that expresses this. And based on her equation, we can make kindness go viral if every time someone does something nice to us, we do more than one nice thing for someone else. Just a little bit more. Return the favor, pay it forward, and do just a little bit more, and we can make this thing go viral. Any number more than one, and kindness becomes unstoppable. This is how we change the planet. This is how we restore our faith in humanity. Now, that's not such a heavy lift, is it? I mean, if we're all doing it, it's a rather manageable and easy lift for all of us. It only becomes a heavy lift if most of us don't pay it forward. So start thinking about all the ways that you can be kind. Think about who you can be kind to. Think about the different ways you can express kindness, especially to people you dislike, don't understand, or disagree with. Ron Cole, the recently installed president of Allegheny College, spoke to our morning Rotary Club and discussed his vision for the college. And I asked Ron, when he talked about the enrollment issues that they're having, the challenges, and how they need to get their enrollment back up. Even though they've made some adjustments in terms of their overall enrollment, they're still behind where they should be. And it's clear to me that they're not going to find another 100 students here in Western PA. The college is going to have to reach out to the other parts of the country, as they already do, and around the world, which means we're more likely to see black and brown students in this community than we ever have before. And we know that these students sometimes come under harassment, get called out, get called ugly names, and are made to feel less welcome in this community, only because it's a small handful of people who are doing so. But what can we do to be proactive? How can we show these young people who are coming into our community that this is really a kind and welcoming place to be? Can we have social mixers? Could the church hold a mixer for students their first year in college? Could we, as residents of this community, host dinners and have students come to our homes? I mean, there's so many things I think we could do to make students feel more welcome. And let's not stop there. What can we do to make others feel more welcome in this community? Every so often when I go through one of the fast food lines, the person in front of me pays for my lunch. I love that. How do we do more of that? I have a whole piece here on how to treat people you have a hard time dealing with, but I think I'll skip that. Let's just stay positive here. But one of the key lessons is just don't go there. Stay away from those subjects that you know you're going to disagree on. Try to change the subject. Keep it positive, and let's focus on the things that we have in common. Since there are always opportunities and great ways to be kind, kindness then will forever have a place in our lives and in our world as long as we continue to intentionally choose it. Practicing gratitude makes this choice even easier. So, another movie reference. Some of you will know the work of Frank Capra. He did It's a Wonderful Life. He also did this movie called Meet John Doe. It stars Gary Cooper in the lead role. And at some point, Gary Cooper is giving a speech that goes out over the radio. And he says this: "We've all got to get in there and pitch. We can't win the old ball game unless we have teamwork. And that's where every John and Jane Doe comes in." I added the Jane. They didn't make those references 40, 50 years ago. "It's up to us to get together with our teammates. And your teammates, my friends, are the people next door to you, your neighbor. You're going to need them, and they're going to need you. So look them up. If they're sick, call on them. If they're hungry, feed them. If they're out of a job, find them one. To most of you, your neighbor is a stranger, a person with a barking dog and a high fence around them. Now, you can't be a stranger to any person that's on your own team. So tear down the fence that separates you. Tear down the fence, and you'll tear down a lot of hate and prejudice. Tear down all the fences in the country, and you'll really have something special. Yes, sir, my friends, the meek can only inherit the earth when the John and Jane Does start loving their neighbors. And you better start right now. Don't wait till the game is called on account of darkness. Wake up, John and Jane Doe. You're the hope of the world." Now, I know that's a little Pollyannish, another movie reference. But, you know, without opportunities to do something nice for someone else, show a little kindness and gratitude, I mean, what else is there? We can't just continue to fill our homes with stuff and engage in only those activities that benefit ourselves. Let's spread the joy. We have musicians here that we had the opportunity of hearing, and that is a way of spreading joy. We have the opportunity to meet with one another and socialize. There's joy in that activity. I'm grateful that we have a church like the Unitarian Universalist Church that welcomes everyone, and we all can feel welcome while they're here and worshiping. So there's much to be grateful for and so many opportunities to share kindness. Let's be the center of gravity here, friends. Let's be that thing that is the catalyst for kindness in our community. You know, if Austin can be kept weird, and if Milwaukee can be known for its beer, why can't Meadville be known for its kindness? And I think it can start right here with all of us. So, thank you.
Before we go on,